Professor Mihai Netea is head of the Division of Experimental Medicine at the Radboud University in the Netherlands. One of his main contributions is the description of trained immunity, which is the capacity for the innate immune system to display memory characteristics and enhance responsiveness to secondary stimuli. Since the first conceptualization of trained immunity in 2011, his group has been characterizing the epigenetic and metabolic mechanisms that underpin it, especially in the context of BCG vaccination. In this episode, we discuss the properties of trained immunity, some evolutionary considerations, and how we can harness it therapeutically. So maybe we can start with an introduction of your background and the scientific path that currently led you to be interested in trained immunity.
So I'm an internist and infectious diseases specialist working at the Radboud University Medical Center in the Netherlands in Nijmegen. And well, I'm studying for quite a bit of time already the innate immune responses in severe infections. I was always interested a lot in trying to understand what are the cytokine network pathways in sepsis, what are the possibilities for immunotherapy in severe infections, and so on. In the last 10 years or so, we also started to be interested in how do vaccines modulate innate immune responses. And this is kind of different from what is usually studied in terms of vaccines, because vaccines are meant to improve memory through adaptive immune responses through T cells and B cells. We started, however, to be interested in innate immune responses as well, because we observed that some of the vaccines have heterologous effects outside the target disease. Just to give you an example, certain vaccines such as measles-containing vaccines or variola vaccines, BCG, Bacillus-Calmette-Guérin vaccines have been reported in various epidemiological studies to protect not only against the target disease, but also more broadly against various type of infections. Similarly, BCG, for example, is used for the treatment of bladder cancer through some of these non-specific heterologous effects on immunity. So we started to be interested in that, and that's how we started to work on this subject.
And then maybe we can go exactly into defining trained immunity. But before, I'd like to speak very briefly about challenging dogma, because obviously at the time, it was dogma that the innate immune system did not really have memory characteristics, that was only adaptive immunity. And there's a sentence in one of your reviews that quite struck me that goes, the dichotomy between innate and adaptive immunity is just an academic simplification. And I guess this holds true of many classification schemes in science. So in your case, when did you see it as necessary to push against the current conceptual frameworks instead of thinking, oh, I need to try to make my evidence fit inside them?
Well, first of all, of course, scientific, generalizations can be misleading sometimes, but they can be also very useful. I mean, there is a reason why we decided more than 50 years ago to divide the immune responses into non-specific innate immune responses and adaptive specific responses, because there are also important differences in the way that cells recognize pathogens, they respond to pathogens, and so on. So there was good reason to do that, because it helps our understanding of the immune responses. On the other hand, we should not forget, when we start to specialize each of us in certain cell type, in certain immune responses, that they do not work in splendid isolation. They actually work together with each other. They interact with each other. And there are also similarities in the types of the responses that are induced. So that is one point. The moment that we started to ask ourselves whether more is true or more characteristics are present in innate immune responses, when we studied the literature that was available for more than 80, 90 years on the effects of BCG, for example, in which is clearly described that BCG vaccination can protect against other types of infections than tuberculosis. And then we could not explain that by the simple use of the memory responses induced in T and B cells, because those memory responses are antigen specific. They are very nicely calibrated for a certain pathogen based on antigen recognition and so on. So we could not explain, for example, protection against viral infections by BCG by thinking that we induce specific T and B cells. So at that moment, we needed to understand what are the cells that might respond better after BCG vaccination, yet they are antigen independent. So at that moment, we had to think about innate immune cells, because only those are more broadly responsive to all types of pathogens. They react relatively non-specifically, and yet they can build a certain memory, non-specific memory of a previous encounter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as you say, trained immunity stem from this quite diffuse set of observations of non-specific reduction in child mortality after BCG vaccination, but now we have a better grasp on cell types, on mechanisms. So maybe if we talk about some of these mechanisms specifically, there's firstly epigenetic modification by histones, and then secondly, metabolic reprogramming. So maybe firstly, what kind of epigenetic signatures are associated with the trained immunity? And more specifically, how do we know that they're causally linked?
So there is a complex interaction. During induction and after induction of trained immunity, there is a very complex interaction of immunological signals, which are induced upon recognition of a pathogen or a vaccine or a certain ligand, which induce changes in the transcriptional program, but also in the metabolic programming of a cell. And that leads through accumulation, for example, of metabolites, which are cofactors for epigenetic enzymes, to changes in the epigenetic program of the cell. What do I mean by that? By that, it is especially meant that chemical changes in the histone induced changes in chromatin architecture that makes it easier for transcription factors, for example, to bind to the promoters, to initiate gene transcription, and so on. And why do we think that this is important? First of all, of course, because there is a strong association of this type of chemical changes in the histones, also in DNA methylation during induction of trained immunity, but also during functional studies in which we blocked these processes. So you can block these processes by inhibiting certain epigenetic enzymes. We did also experiments in mice that were defective in some of these epigenetic factors. And we have observed at that point that when we block that, then we cannot induce this process of trained immunity, this non-specific protection.
And is there a way to use epigenetic inhibitors that are specific, or do you have to use some that wipe all of it and then infer from that? That it was, like, for example, a H3K4 methylation.
So there are possibility to inhibit specifically certain histone marks, for example, because there are specific epigenetic enzymes which methylate or acetylate certain lysines and certain components of the histone. So you have a certain specificity there. What is more difficult is to modify these histone changes only at certain levels of the DNA in certain genes. That is much more difficult. But in terms of specificity of the epigenetic changes, so let's say H3K4 methylation or H3K27 acetylation, you can relatively specifically modulate that by inhibiting or stimulating it, because there is specificity in the enzymes which mediate these processes.
Mm-hmm. And then, so the second well-described change is metabolic rewiring, and especially this shift that you observe from oxidative phosphorylation to glycolysis. So this results in increased glucose utilization, increased lactate production. Do you rationalize this as more simply more energy being needed for cytokine production for membrane turnover? Or does this metabolic change reflect some more profound alteration in the behavior of trained myeloid cells?
There are both things which are true in what you are saying. The cells does need more energy, and the energy is extracted, especially from glycolysis, because glycolysis can upregulate much easier than other metabolic processes. But at the same time, it's not only simply energy expenditure. because we see that the Krebs cycles is rewired. There are changes in the abundance of certain metabolites of the Krebs cycles with accumulation of certain of these metabolites, such as fumarate and succinate, and they act as modulators of epigenetic enzymes. So there is an interaction between energy expenditure, energy use, and also the usefulness of certain metabolites in the cells as modulators of epigenetic processes.
Mm-hmm. And I guess if an infectious trigger changes immune function through metabolic reprogramming, the reverse could also occur. So in an altered metabolic environment, for example, in diabetes or in other metabolic disorders, could we also have this, that it templates an altered state in innate cells that then changes response to infectious triggers?
Unfortunately, we can, because of course, during infection, this is useful to happen. But if that is happening at the wrong time, at the wrong place, induced by the wrong stimuli, that can lead to hyperinflammatory reactions and so on. And that is unfortunately happening. For example, we have shown that oxidized LDL can induce this type of reaction as an endogenous inducer of train immunity. Other colleagues have shown also that there is a hyperglycemic memory, that hyperglycemia itself can induce some of these processes and can lead to long-term inflammatory processes in diabetes, for example. So unfortunately, yes, that happens. And that leads to an inappropriate induction of train immunity in some inflammatory diseases.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned long-term, and I guess that's something we could talk about, because it's an apparent conundrum that immune training effects can be durable, but the half-life of some of the subsets like monocytes is just like, what, 2-3 days? So how can mm-hmm. trained immunity effects essentially exceed the lifespan of the populations involved?
Yes, this is a very important point. And what is happening, in fact, is that these changes do not occur only at the level of the circulating cells, which have indeed a very limited lifetime, but they are also taking place at the level of bone marrow progenitors of these cells. So similar type of changes are present in the hematopoietic stem cells, in the progenitors of the myeloid cells, which thereafter induce the release of daughter cells in the circulation, which have similar changes in their transcriptional and functional programs. So basically, these things are happening at the central level in the bone marrow, and that results to a long-term, and I mean by long-term, months, weeks, months, maybe a couple of years thereafter. I have to stress, however, that this train immunity reprogramming of the innate immune cells and this increase in responsiveness is still much shorter than the memory induced in TMB cells, which in certain conditions, when it's properly activated, can persist for decades and sometimes for your entire life. In case of train immunity responses, we see that probably 1 or 2 years is the maximum lifespan, let's say, of such a response. It's a much more plastic response, and these programs can be lost at the level of the bone marrow in time.
So adaptive immunity evolved in vertebrates around the ancestors of vertebrates around 450 million years ago. And since now we have this adaptive immune system, which, as you say, has a better durability and immunological memory and also specificity, can we suppose that trained immunity came to have less and less of an importance? It's true that the selective pressures imposed by pathogens do shape a lot on the evolution of populations. So for example, could we do population genetics to look at the genes involved in trained immunity and see if there's traces of like positive selection, for example?
Absolutely, there are some of these some of these signatures. I do agree with you, however, that for example, in plants or in vertebrate animals in which we do not have adaptive immune responses, it is likely that trained immunity responses, or in insects they are called, or in vertebrates, innate priming, or in plants it's called systemic acquired resistance. But basically, they all are the same biological process. It is likely that it's more important for them because they cannot mount other types of memory responses. And it is still possibly that the relative importance in vertebrates is smaller compared with invertebrates and plants, because we do have also adaptive immune responses through TMB cells. That being said, it is still, we observe that these effects are still very strongly induced, and they are still present in invertebrates as well in mammals and so on. So they are still likely to be very important.
I mean, obviously, vertebrates make up a minority of life forms, and all of the other ones have to make do with these mechanisms that are probably akin to trained immunity. I wonder if we are studying any of these more ancestral life forms in the lab, because usually, like, boundary cases in biology can teach us a lot. And if we take some atypical organisms with extreme phenotypes, or some that are, I guess, more ancestral, there'd be a lot to learn. Maybe not so much in terms of translational purpose for trained immunity, but in its evolutionary biology. Do you think there's any of these organisms or model systems that we could learn a lot from?
Of course. I mean, this is already happening. And well, the classical example is, of course, Drosophila, in which a lot of the immune processes that are common also in vertebrates have been described for the first time in Drosophila. We should not forget toll-like receptors have been, for example, first time described, a classical example, a very important discovery. And it is likely that in terms of innate immune memory, trained immunity, whatever we want to call it, there will be important insights that can be gained by studying invertebrates, even plants maybe. So I fully agree, and it is certain that a lot of pathways, for example, the role of epigenetic processes in innate immune memory has been for the first time studied, and that's where a lot of information has come from plants. In plants, these processes have been described probably at least, 5 to 10 years earlier than in vertebrates. And in insects, we are still waiting actually to learn a lot about the epigenetic processes mediating immune priming. So yes, I do think that model organisms, various models in different types of animals, have an important role in trying to understand the biology of these processes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, even Drosophila is an invertebrate, but it's still relatively mainstream. Whereas if we look, for example, at I think it's a lamprey fish that are these jawless organisms, but that also generate diversity through like rearrangement of some receptors.
Absolutely. They have actually a completely different type of adaptive immunity. So jawless fish, they do have a completely different type of memory based on lymphocytes, which is very, very interesting and very, very exciting. The same could be also in insects. Actually, we know the variety of invertebrates is so big, and the level at which we know innate immune responses in all the invertebrates animals is so much poorer than in vertebrates, for example, that I'm sure that there is a lot of scope for discovery. I also do not exclude the possibility that actually there might be also some specific immune memory in insects, for example, as well, because there are some tantalizing experimental models suggesting that, but the biological substrate of that is not known. So it's a lot of room for discovery yet.
Yeah, and touching on those evolutionary discussions, there's a shift in the field, which I'm quite fascinated by, is looking at the holobiont, so namely the host and all of its microorganisms, as the unit of natural selection rather than just looking at the host in isolation. And in that context, I guess trained immunity is the product of not only host-microbe interactions, but also microbe-microbe interactions. And there's probably some immune evasion strategies where a pathogen has like hitchhiked along the trained immunity landscape shaped by another pathogen. So maybe also in terms of not necessarily looking at other extreme experimental models, but just incorporating all of the interactions involved in our current experimental models, there's some scope for discovery.
Absolutely. There is also a recent study published in Cell, I think half a year ago, showing actually that a part of the resilience of the microbiome is due also to train type of processes, and that can contribute actually to the both interaction with the host and resistance to other pathogens. So this is completely true, and in the end, that's where we started also from the interaction and the fact that innate immune responses do not work in isolation. There will be interaction at multiple levels, interaction with other arms of the host defense, including of course lymphocytes, but also interaction with other types of cells. There are trained immunity processes that have been described in non-immune cells, in epithelial cells, endothelial cells, probably stroma cells as well, and finally also with a colonizing microbiota. So all these type of interactions lead in fact to the final results. So we have to be aware of them.
And something that's a bit puzzling to me in trained immunity is that, as you say, the protection is heterologous, so it protects against unrelated pathogens more or less non-specifically, but not entirely non-specifically. It doesn't protect against everything. So for example, one context where trained immunity is probably involved is Barton's findings that in herpes viral latency, the mice are better protected against infection by Listeria, monocytogenes, and Yersinia, but for example, not by West Nile virus. So how can we explain the patches of protection, whereas protection occurs against some pathogens, but not others? How can we make sense of that?
So what is happening also during induction of trained immunity, for example, one of the vaccines that we are studying, BCG, is not automatically inducing protection against everything. You do have better protection against certain pathogens, but not against others. And how can we explain that is through the epigenetic changes that take place during the first exposure to the pathogen. Because when we stimulate for the first time of the cell, the specific places where the epigenetic changes take place are the genes which are necessary for the host defense against the primary pathogen. So for example, if you for the first pathogen or vaccine, you need the gene ABC to be activated, well, you will undergo the epigenetic changes in the promoters and enhancers of genes A, B, and C. Now, those will remain bookmarked through epigenetic changes after the elimination of the infection. And let's suppose that 3 months later you encounter pathogen 2. And if genes A, B, and C are necessary for the host defense against pathogen 2, then you have protection. But if by accident you are infected by pathogen 3, for which genes A, B, and C are not important, or maybe only C, but A and B not, then it's not helping you that you bookmarked, let's say, genes A, B, and C, because then you are not protected against pathogen 3, because just by accident, those are not genes which are necessary. So there is not a complete non-specific induction of protection against everything. If the genes that you modulated the first time are necessary also for the next infection, then you are protected. But if they are not, well, you're not then. So there is still a specificity, and probably for herpes is the same. If the genes which are induced and upregulated by herpes are important for certain infections, but not for the others, that's why you see the difference in protection.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so supposedly the more different the immune response that's mounted, the less likely you are to get protection. So if you get something like that's in extracellular and as opposed to intracellular, then you're decreasing and so on and so on.
Yeah, but it's not very easy to predict that, because for example, well, BCG protects very well, for example, against influenza in several models. But that does not mean that, for example, it would automatically protect against any type of virus just because it protects against one virus. And there are already indications that probably is much less protective against COVID-19 than against influenza. So there is still not easy to predict that because we don't know everything about all the pathogens.
How do you expect that will come about? Is it like the computational methods that will do the learning for us in a sense and like fish out the variables or?
I think that could help, but in the end, the only way of doing it and knowing for sure is doing either an experiment or a clinical trial. I think that biology is so complex and the system is so complex that it is not easy to predict computationally the behavior. In the end, we will have to do the experiment for the foreseeable future, in my view.
Okay. But yeah, so maybe talking about clinical trials, we can talk about just generally how we can translate trained immunity to therapeutics. And we run into this sticky situation because in the case of adaptive immunity, it is desirable to have a response that's orders of magnitude higher. Like typically you would have several log higher antibody titers with immunization. And that's okay because there's specificity built in the adaptive immune system where it keeps its laser sharp focus to the antigen. But we can't massively increase the response in innate immunity because that would lead to this non-specific cytokine release type situations. So we probably have to operate in this quite narrow therapeutic margin if we try to drug trained immunity. How do you expect that we can do that and achieve such fine-tuned modulation?
Yes, I think that in the end, therapeutic use of trained immunity will be most successful in areas of specific subpopulations rather than massive population-based approaches. And what do I mean by that? For example, we know for sure that the anti-tumor immunity, just to give an example, is poor in patients with cancer. And we know that, for example, the tumor-associated macrophages have a strong immunosuppressive phenotype in cancer. That is the cell that we need to reprogram and to use trained immunity approaches to reprogram those cells. So the CD8 cells, which are unfortunately repressed by these macrophages in the cancer patients, can do their job and kill the tumor cells. So we have to focus, I think, in the use of trained immunity in specific populations at risk, for example, to identify immunomodulators that can boost the immunotherapy given by checkpoint inhibitors in cancer, or approaching populations at high risk for infections. Those are the newborn, for example, or the elderly who are at very high risk for infections and severe outcome, rather than go very indiscriminately in the entire population. So I think that the trained immunity will need to be used indeed focused in certain subpopulations that are needing it.
And then concerning the types of compounds that would be used, you've already done some randomized control trials actually with some pretty common drugs, so aspirin and metformin, which is that wasn't a clinical trial, but essentially some other experiments with this widely used diabetes drugs. And so since these are quite common compounds already licensed, do you think that a major avenue in developing therapeutics will be like repurposing currently existing drugs?
Absolutely. Drug repurposing is very important because we very often have drugs for one disease, but we have no idea that it might work in other diseases as well. So drug repurposing is a very important avenue that is explored by many people, not only by us. And absolutely, I'm almost sure that in the end, drug repurposing has one important place in remodeling trained immunity responses, especially for inhibition, for example, but maybe even for stimulation of trained immunity. So we are following some of these paths through, especially to inhibit inappropriate trained immunity responses in certain diseases characterized by over inflammation.
Mm-hmm. So I guess there on one side there's repurposing, and then on a second would be developing some more maybe high tech and rational compounds. And some of those are like nanobiologics. Can you maybe speak about them and why they would be most adapted to deliver the payload just to myeloid cells?
Yeah, so we again had our inspiration in nature in a way. So we knew that BCG helps in bladder cancer, but BCG is a live microorganism, a live attenuated Mycobacterium bovis. It's administered intravesically, but the urinary bladder basically is outside our body in a way, because it is it has direct contact with the exterior of the body. And because of that, it does not allow, let's say, an overt dissemination of the microorganism in all the body. So if we can treat bladder cancer with BCG, we cannot treat, for example, lung cancer or pancreatic cancer with BCG, because we cannot inject a live Mycobacterium bovis around the tumor and so on. So because of that, we thought of what could be alternative approaches, and we identified a compound from BCG which induces the train immunity responses, and we built it in artificial particles in nanobiologics, which were basically balls of fat, cholesterols and phospholipids and so on, in which we built the muramil D-peptide, which is the component from BCG that induces train immunity. And in such a way, we build kind of nanomicrobes which can induce train immunity that can be safely administered intravenously. And we have already performed experiments in animal models, and we see very encouraging results. And now we are trying to develop that also for human use.
And I mean, how's the specificity to the target achieved?
That is very important as well. Indeed, we have used nanobiologic based on high density lipoproteins, basically, which are taken up specifically by the myeloid cells. And by using that particular form of nanoparticle, we can target the payload, which is in this case the muramil D-peptide, to the myeloid cells and induce the reprogramming of the myeloid cells in these cancer models.
Mm-hmm. So in cancer models, that's one of the main...
This is one of our main targets to improve immunotherapy in cancer by reprogramming the immunosuppressive phenotype of macrophages into anti-tumor active inflammatory profiles.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, so cancer is a big one, but then there's obviously maybe harnessing trained immunity in vaccinations, which was the area where the observations initially stemmed from. And as we say, so BCG was the initial context of description, but also polio and measles. And obviously that leads
also many of the adjuvants, actually adjuvanticity, what we understand with adjuvanticity, it is a component of trained immunity, in fact, because it improves the capacity of myeloid cells to present antigens and so on, but at the same time to improve the function of the myeloid cells themselves against pathogens. So unconsciously, we already do that in vaccines, but of course, as you mentioned, we can improve that actually and build hopefully in the future vaccines which combine a strong trained immunity capacity with an improved adaptive immune response and memory responses through TMB cells.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that strikes me because I'm quite a big believer in like reverse vaccinology and targeting disease from first principles and so on when we choose the antigen first. But here we see that maybe a part of the immunity we're getting is something we were actually quite blind to. So you say there's space for us to repurpose it rationally, but how might that come about? So for example, BCG, we know it's quite a good inducer of trained immunity. That may not be the case of all vaccine platforms. Yeah, so how do we go about finding which platforms are good inducers of trained immunity and maybe modifying them so to enhance that?
That's an excellent question. I think in the end, we have to do the studies. For example, let's take the two major platforms which are used for COVID-19 vaccines, adenoviruses, which are in the AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson vaccines, or the messenger RNA vaccines, which are actually built also in nanoparticles as used by Moderna and BioNTech. We have no idea whether these new platforms induce effects only on TMB cells, or do they have also an effect on innate immunity. And I do think that we need to study that first to see what kind of effects might they have on innate immune responses. And if we find that, and if we would think, well, we should modulate that or improve that or whatever, there are ways of improving that by adding adjuvants or other components to these vaccines to improve their efficacy. I mean, these vaccines, for example, the messenger RNA vaccines now are incredibly important in our fight against COVID-19, but we do see now that we need rather often boosters. Maybe we can improve that by helping to understand what are the impacts on innate immunity, what are they not doing, for example, and what they are doing, and improve those responses by building a new generation of messenger RNA based vaccines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, maybe some metric of trained immunity should now be included in immunogenicity phase of vaccine trials. So usually we just look at like antibody titers or interferon gamma T cell responses. But if we were to screen for some trained immunity effect from the start, then maybe we could be kind of securing some better efficacy downstream.
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, we need to study that better. And then indeed try in experimental models to improve, to add to the existing specific vaccine a trained immunity component and see whether they would work better. So I think that these type of studies are really needed in the coming period.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you personally, to finish off, what question, either fundamental or translational, in the field of trained immunity are you the most keen about investigating in the upcoming years?
Well, for me as a clinician, the most important part is how can we use it in patients. So we are studying very intensively how can we improve trained immunity responses in cancer, but also for vaccines and for immunosuppression in sepsis, for example. And on the other hand, how should we inhibit that in inflammatory diseases in which there is inappropriate activation? So this is one of the most important thing, translation for us. But of course, at the biology level, there are very important, there is a lot of important work that still needs to be done. We are interested in what are the transcription factors and the precise epigenetic factors, which are epigenetic enzymes, which are necessary for induction of trained immunity. What is the level of heterogeneity at the cellular level? We study now monocytes or NK cells or innate lymphoid cells, for example, or whatever in totality, but other subpopulations that are very important for different type of diseases and so on. So these are all very important questions that need to be answered in the future.
Mm-hmm. This is a call for researchers to come in this field.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for your time for this interview.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you.